Morning, everyone. No, afternoon, everyone. It's 1:04 on May 18th. Let's see. Welcome to Senate Finance. Present with us this afternoon are Senator Green, Senator Stevens, Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, and myself, Senator Wilkin. The purpose of today's meeting is to do legislation, which you have in front of you, an agenda. Pretty much, I was going to say follow that. No, we're going to skip around. So before we do that, is there anything else that come before the committee before we begin our consideration of the calendar?
Are you sure we can afford all these?
Senator Hoffman. Okay, then let's start. Let's do a couple of quick ones and so folks can get back to work. Let's start first with HJR 27, support of Anchorage Jail expansion. It should be on the bottom of your pile. We just received it. HJR 27 encouraged the United States Congress to appropriate $30 million for a 200-bed expansion at the Anchorage Jail to house additional federal prisoners. And who's here? Lorelei, you're going to present the bill. Come forward, please. It's sponsored by Representative Kevin Meyer. And Lorelei is here to present it. Welcome to Finance. We would present the bill.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Lorelei Carter. I'm staff for Representative Meyer. I understand your time is short this morning, so I will be brief. The resolution encourages the federal government to appropriate $30 million for a 200-bed expansion to the Anchorage Jail.
Okay. Questions of the bill's prime sponsor, staff? Will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move HJR 27 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Your objection to moving the bill? Seeing none, HJR 27 passes from committee. Thank you, Lorelei. Next, let's go to Representative Seaton. His bill is House Bill 232. House Bill 232 allows the Homer chapter of the Kenai Peninsula Boys and Girls Club to operate and implement the Homer Mercury Classic. And the sponsor is Representative Seaton. So you would please present your bill. And before you do that, Dave, is Senator Olson headed our way? Okay. All right. If you would please, Representative Seaton, welcome to Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. House Bill 232 would establish Homer Mercury Classic. It'd be similar to other classics, such as the Indiana Ice Classic. Would allow the Boys and Girls Club to offer the tickets would be $2. 50% of that would be paid out in prizes. There has been a couple of Mercury Classics before in Fairbanks in 1987 and 1988 are the only other authorized Mercury Classics in the state, but it hasn't been conducted since then. The Boys and Girls Club has a computerized weather station on top of their building, which will allow for monitoring of the temperature, and so it will be in the spring, the first hour in which the temperature reaches 55, and in the fall, the first day or first hour when it reaches 15 degrees. And so that's the basics. I know your time is short, so if you want more explanation, I can give it, or if that, I'll stop.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Questions of the bill's prime sponsor? Senator Bundy?
I had a Fairbanks amendment here that said those qualifying temperatures would be 80 above and 40 below.
Yes. All right. Other pertinent questions?
We're going to get technical.
Other amendments? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one.
I'll object for clarification. Does everyone have amendment number one in their packets? Senator Olson, explanation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number one has to deal with the ability for an organization to go ahead and go past the limits that are currently in statute of $1 million in specific games of skill. So that you can go past $1 million and able to go ahead and get an additional $500,000 in prize money that are to be awarded to people that participate within some of these contests. And if you look at the, if you go ahead and look at the amendment, the portion that's added in there has to do with the municipality or qualified organization, and this is done on the behalf of, more specifically, the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, which has been a very popular addition to a number of issues that are up in Western Alaska during the winter months.
Welcome, Senator Taylor. Questions regarding amendment number one? Senator Olson, I have a couple. Has the Iditarod or any other game of chance hit the $1 million limit?
As far as I know.
I think Senator Green may be able to help us with that. Senator Green?
It appears that on a transmittal from the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, on day May 17th, they approached and have surpassed $1 million in 2000.
Okay,
that's anticipated.
So thank you. So that would establish the amendment as needed. Senator Olson, there was some discussion about the legality of this amendment. Has it passed the muster of our legal department?
Certainly there have been questions that have been raised related to single issue items, but as far as its applicability to our particular case, it seems to be able to go ahead and be able to, is able to pass it as far as I know.
Okay, I just want to make sure that was on the record. Other questions regarding amendment number one? Senator Taylor?
Without amendment number one, I think the bill itself might be more subject to criticism as single subject, as it only involves one town and specifically one charity. I can't imagine how you could get much more specific than that. By adding the amendment, you, if anything, broaden the bill.
Other discussion on amendment number one? I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. The bill's back before you as amended. Is there further discussion on the bill? Will of the committee?
Chairman.
Senator Green?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 232, Homer Mercury Classics, as amended with individual recommendations and a zero fiscal vote.
Is there objection to passing House Bill 232 from committee?
Just for inquiry, would the sponsor mind if we also added an amendment that would roll in video gaming and
and a sales tax?
No. You take care of that.
All right.
I would withdraw.
Further objection to moving House Bill 232. Seeing none, House Bill 232 passes. Next, excuse me, just a minute. Have a seat and have a seat there just for a second. We can go off the record here. Thanks, Rep. Same seat. Okay. You guys almost let me get away with that. Right?
You were slacking there.
All right, let's bring forward 248. House Bill 248. Dan, if you come forward. House Bill 248, sponsored by the Rules Committee by the request of the governor. No, that's okay. House Bill 248 changes the salary of the state's chief procurement officer from range 23 to range 24. By statute, the chief procurement officer is appointed to a 6-year term and may be removed only for cause. This is its second hearing. Is anything further to come before the committee? Senator Taylor?
Move the bill with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note and then object for the purpose that I think if anything ever came close to a specific bill concern, this would be it. It only involves one person, and even more narrowly than that, a salary range. It should have been included in something a little more broad, but other than that, I withdraw that objection.
Senator Tedder, motions made to move to committee. Senator Olson?
For a comment.
Yeah, just Senator Olson, then Senator Bundy.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'd like to object and for a question, if I could.
Yeah, sure.
When was the last time that it was moved up? How long has it been at the rate 23?
Dan, if you could, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know. I think it's been that way since the statute was adopted. I don't know the date of that adoption.
Senator Olson,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, and just for the public, when you talk about increase for salary, wanted to clarify that this fellow will actually be doing two jobs, and by passing this bill, we will decrease actual expenditures because we'll get rid of a deputy. I mean, we'll remove the need for a deputy.
That's part of the record. And okay. Is there other objection to passing the bill from committee? Seeing none, House Bill 248 passes from committee. Thank you, Dan, for being here. Let's see, House Bill 165, let's bring that back before us, having to do with community schools for its second hearing. House Bill 165 eliminates the community schools grant program. $500,000 from this program has been deleted in both the House and Senate operating budgets. The House bill includes intent language regarding the community schools. Further discussion on House Bill 165?
Individual recommendation.
Motion's been made to move from committee. Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 165 passes from committee. Thank you. Okay. Let's then go to the top of our calendar and pick up two ADA bills. Start with Senate Bill 73. Let's see who's going to be here from ADA. Sarah, Mike, you want to come forward, please? Okay. We should have before us a version I. If you'll remember, this has to do with ADA loan participation. Let's see, in the earlier version, it had the issue in regard to the Healy Clean Coal being purchased by AEA. It had an extension of ADA's general bonding, and it had to do with the Red Dog issue. The version you have before you, which I would ask for a motion to adopt, has to do with only one item, and that is the ADA loan participation. So, everything else is not in this bill. So if I could have a motion to adopt version I as our working document.
Mr. Chairman, I would move version I of Senate Bill 73 for our working document today.
I'd object just for discussion and clarification. Mike, if you would, please, any discussion on my rather jerky analysis or explanation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Berry from ADA's Board of Directors. First, I'd like to apologize for my breach of your decorum. I will have a tie next time I come before the committee. I think you are correct in the deletion of the items that you mentioned. This bill is designed to go to the House. They've heard the other issues, and we're taking the Healy issue off the table in both sides. And so we wanted a clean bill to go to the House for the hearing over there tomorrow.
Thanks for that. I know my utility had, it was concern probably more from just an analysis of what was going on in the press of time. So we'll come back and visit that over the interim. So I appreciate that. Let's see, other discussion on Senate Bill 73. Will of the committee?
Move with individual recommendations. Substitute number 73, finance.
Oh, let's see.
CS. That has been adopted.
Yeah, thank you. If there's no objection, let's do that first. I remove my objection to version I. Is version I then our working document?
It's the one before us. I'd move adoption.
Okay. All right. So version I is our working document. Okay. Now,
Is there a motion to pass from committee?
Move that we report out the bill with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Is there objection to passing Senate Bill 73? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just make a comment. Since Cameco has been taken care of with House Bill 112, Senate Bill 73 is, we've got no further comment. It's okay with us.
Okay. No objection to passing Senate Bill 73, then it passes from committee. Thank you, Ms. Irina Stager from 112. Let's bring before us House Bill 112. House Bill 112 we've had before us. We have a new version, a CS, which everyone should have, which is version U, uniform. And I'd entertain a motion to adopt version U and then have it explained.
Move.
Is there objection? I'll object for clarification. The newest version extends ADA's bonding authority up to $10 million to July 1 of 07, which they have asked for. It also extends the municipal tax exemption for the Long Mountain Transportation System until July 1st of 07. Mr. Berry or Sarah, would you like to any comment, Mike?
We have no comments if there are any questions.
Okay.
What was the last sentence you said, the Long Mountain?
It extends the Red Dog exemption on property tax until 07.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
It's in the bonds run for and stuff.
Yeah.
It's the intent of the administration. With the help of the state assessor through this process over the last couple of months, to work on some formal legislation that sets forth these decisions that the legislature will consider next year, so we don't have to have these discussions in the future. And I've been assured that this won't have any effect on Pogo or Donlin Creek or those types of things. Those types of things will be considered in the legislation that the administration intends to work on over the interim and introduce next year. So, Senator Taylor?
Any further testimony or questions, I'd move the bill.
Hey, just Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Okay, we're working off of W or?
Uniform.
Uniform. Are we not going to adopt W?
I have U as our working document, unless somebody, yes. Was for Senate Bill 112.
I'm sorry.
And we're on House Bill 112.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only comment that I have is that Cameco is obviously working up in my district, and they are okay with the Senate Bill 112 version U.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I appreciate everybody's work to work this thing through.
Appreciate your work as well.
Did we adopt it, or did we need to?
Let's just make sure. I had a motion on the table to adopt U. I objected. I removed my objection. Is there any objection to having U as our working document? Seeing none, will of the committee?
Move the move the CS for House Bill 112 Finance U version Cook 51703 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection to passing version U House Bill 112? Seeing none, House Bill 112 passes from committee. Thank you, Mike,
thank
and Sarah, for being
Chair.
Here, and for your help on this issue also. Next, let's bring before us... Senator Olson. Yeah. Senator Olson?
There seems to be some confusion. Are we working off House Bill 112 or Senate Bill 112?
Which...
she had the wrong packet. It's the same number.
Had before us?
Yes.
One we had before it was House Bill 112.
Which is ADA bonds and municipal exemptions.
Well, we had the Senate bill.
We had the Senate bill.
That was
confusing.
That was the packet.
We had Senate Bill 73.
We also have 112, Senate Bill 112 on the schedule today.
Right. It's Senate Bill 73. Let's take it at ease and we'll make sure we've got them here. Senate Bill 112, let's bring that forward. Kevin, if you'd come forward and help us. Senate Bill 112 is the increase in the motor fuel tax. You have a new version before you, and it is version whiskey, dated 517. I would entertain a motion to adopt version W as our working document.
I shall move.
Thank you, Senator Greenwood. And
We'll all object.
We're going to all object, and that's why Kevin is here. So, This bill has changed substantially. It's gotten, it went on a diet. So, Kevin, if you'd identify yourself and please present version W.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Jardell, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Administration. It is no longer the motor fuel tax bill. The uncontroversial portions have been removed. Our finance division, when they went out to RFP for the contract for the credit card, one of the big provisions in that was the ability to use that credit card to purchase fuel. You've heard my spiel on that on a prior hearing. This bill was chosen as the vehicle to attach it to. This bill doesn't seem to be moving this year, so we are removing all of the motor fuel tax portions of it, leaving the credit card fix to our problem, and moving just the credit card fix.
All right. Questions of Kevin? Senator Taylor?
The provision shifting the railroad refund back from 6 cents per gallon to 18.
No.
Page 4.
No, this is the version there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I worked on the wrong version. I had U.
Should be whiskey.
Yeah. Well, let me dig. I'll find
the chair. Everything will be removed except for the credit card fix.
Here. There you go.
Never mind.
Dr. Allison, one comment on your interpretation of the version. In my book, it's not whiskey, it's Wilkin. Just to let you know, Mr. Chairman.
Alfa Romeo.
For a non-aviator.
Mr. Chairman, either one is a long, tall, strong drink.
Okay, now.
Reaching.
3 more days. I want this committee to contain themselves. Any other discussion on version W of Senate Bill 112? Senator Hoffman?
It's a major move in the right direction.
Senator Hoffman. Oh, excuse me. If there's no further objection to adopting W, then it is our working document. Thank you. Further discussion on Senate Bill 112?
Move the bill with individual recommendations. Attach fiscal note.
Is there objection to moving Senate Bill 112 from committee? Seeing none, it passes from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Kevin, for being here. We're going to stand in recess here. We have 3 bills that are coming to us, at least 3. House Bill 216, mini taxation on refined fuel products. House Bill 245, suits and claims for military fire defense. And House Bill 246, limit on oil and gas lease acreage. Those 3 are due to us, so if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll stand in recess to the call of the chair sometime today with the expectation of dealing with those bills and whatever else the other body sends us. Anything else come before the committee? Seeing none, we're in recess. 6:58 on May 18th. And let's bring forward first House Bill 216. Let's do 245 because we've got the commissioner here. Let's, Commissioner, why don't you come forward and let's, who's presenting the bill? Juanita? Somebody. Scott?
Department of Law.
Let's start at the beginning. House Bill 245, sponsored by the Rules Committee by the request of the governor. House Bill 245 limits civil actions arising out of claims and suits by members of the military service, organized militia, and firefighters. State's self-insurance program for tort liability exposures will be favorably affected by this legislation. And it is a bill by the governor. Who's going to present the governor's bill? Oh, right here. Okay, thank you. So we have Gail Voigtlander on the phone, also Dean Brown from the Division of Forestry. And Gail, you're going to present the bill to us?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Hey, Gail, if you'd please do that.
For the record, my name is Gail Voigtlander. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in Anchorage, Alaska. I'd like to give you an overview of this bill. It basically deals with liability for state and local governments and state and local government workers and volunteers who provide important emergency services to people of the state of Alaska. This bill has as its subject four different areas of emergency response that the state and local government, its workers and volunteers coordinate and work in. First area is that of search and rescue. The Alaska State Troopers perform approximately 400 searches and rescue per year. What this bill does is to provide immunity to the state troopers and other state and local employees and volunteers who are really the ones who are the foot soldiers, so to speak, who go out and perform these search and rescues. This bill and the immunity that it would provide for the performance of the search and rescue activities is consistent with Alaska Supreme Court case law in the area of police services. The Supreme Court has ruled in four different cases in the last several years that it would not recognize a tort for negligent investigation by the police. This bill then extends that and makes it clear that search and rescue and calling of a search and rescue and conducting it is another form of investigation by the police authorities. And so the immunity that it provides is consistent with these cases of Wongatillin, Huck, Wasky, and I believe the last one is Dorr, which all consistently held that you could not file civil lawsuits for damages against the police for their police investigation. The second area that this bill covers is that of intra-military torts. This bill would clarify what was muddied in a Alaska Supreme Court case in 2001, which is called HIMSO v. State. It has always been somewhat confusing the various hats the Alaska National Guard might wear in any given occasion, and that opinion blurred the distinction in terms of what hats the National Guard are wearing, and also who is responsible for paying for or defending against claims made arising out of their activities. What this bill does is clarifies that when the members of the Alaska National Guard are on state orders, then if they are injured, they are provided state workers' comp through the state of Alaska. When they are on federal orders, which is more often than not, they are provided workers' compensation and other benefits through the federal government. The other problem that arose after the HIMSO decision was allowing the military to sue one another in court for civil damages. All but two other jurisdictions in the United States follow what is known as the Ferris Doctrine, that's F-E-R-E-S, and that is a doctrine recognized by the federal government and by, as I said, all but two other jurisdictions, that it is poor public policy to allow the military to sue their officers, their fellow military members, and their employers for military activities. The public policies are two. One is that it is detrimental to the military command structure to have someone give an order, but yet also be subject to civil liability for having given that order. And the other public policy is not to have civilian courts interject themselves into military decisions, operations, and orders. This bill then, the second part dealing with the military, then would again bring Alaska back into alignment and use the Ferris Doctrine as the law up here. I would parenthetically add that this is not a change. It is a change only from the Hensel decision in 2001. It has been, the Ferris Doctrine has been the longstanding rule, and we had, the state had not been responding or had any lawsuits in this area because that rule was so well known, and everyone believes that that rule also applied here in Alaska. Keep in mind that most of the National Guard activities oftentimes are joint activities with federal employees as well, and so you have a mixed bag of people providing services under a variety of order situations. The third subject of the bill is that of civil defense. There is in existing statutes, Title 26, immunity for civil defense activities. This continues that immunity and makes a slightly higher standard for the one exception when lawsuits are allowed in the area of civil defense. Civil defense in Alaska wears several hats, primarily those of responding to natural disasters such as earthquakes and floods, and involves a variety of state and local governments, their workers, and also a host of volunteers. Again, what this bill does in all aspects is to immunize not only the state, but also the individual volunteers and workers who are performing these vital emergency services. Finally, the last area of the bill is that of firefighting activities. Again, this was an area where it was believed that the state could not be sued. However, in two tandem decisions in 2001, Alaska Supreme Court passed on those issues arising out of the Miller's Reach fire, and in the tandem decisions said that no, that there were certain aspects of firefighting activities for which the state could be sued. This bill provides immunity to state and local responders and to volunteers as well, all those who conduct firefighting operations in the state of Alaska, so that, again, they are able to provide these critical emergency activities without the concern when they're making emergency decisions that they may end up being sued personally for these decisions, as well as their employers. And the also the secondary problem that arises, which is for all these emergency workers, that if there is civil litigation, it oftentimes takes them off their job in order to meet deadlines and schedules for trials and depositions and other discovery activities. I would like to add a couple of other points about it. These workers, the state and local employees and volunteers, are all workers who are covered by workers' compensation, so that if they are injured in the course of their activities, they do have the certainty of workers' comp available to them. Workers' comp is a no-fault system where you don't even need to retain an attorney to assert your rights, so you don't have attorney's fees coming off your award. You receive compensation for your medical bills and for your time loss and other matters. In the area of firefighting activities, if I may go back to that briefly, again, this bill would bring Alaska solidly back in with Western states and the Ninth Circuit, which holds that these firefighting activities are immune. So again, the Alaska Supreme Court in 2001 diverged from that body of case law. This bill would take it back to that body of case law.
Thank you, Ms. Voigtlander. Questions? Senator Taylor.
Yeah, I have several. Starting off, I guess, at the beginning of the legislation where you talked in terms of the trying to recall the name of the case. I've got it here on your, apparently there was a decision made by our Supreme Court in Himsel versus the state in 2001 that was at variance with what you testified to as the Ferris standard. I don't see the words Ferris here. Oh, there it is, Ferris doctrine. Who was Himsel and why was he suing?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor. Himsel was, in fact, a member, it was Major General Kenneth Himsel was in the Indiana National Guard, and he was in Alaska as part of his FORSCOM, which is FORSCOM, responsibilities. This lawsuit arose out of a plane crash which was outside of Juneau, which was in a federal plane piloted by a federal pilot. And then there were several members of the Alaska National Guard in the aircraft who were in AGR, Active Guard Reserve status, which traditionally had been a federal status for which they received federal benefits, and they did in this case receive federal benefits. Their spouses and dependent children. Unfortunately, there were all souls were lost in that plane crash. So this lawsuit was then arguing over whether this was a state or a federal mission, and then the Alaska Supreme Court, in rejecting the Ferris Doctrine test, which is whether injuries arose incident to military service, which these certainly did, the Alaska Supreme Court substituted a new test, which is referred to as the uniquely military test. This lawsuit was settled, the state's portion of the settlement is $2.75 million, which is being funded through the bills this session. The total settlement was $7.5 million. The difference between the two figures was covered by insurance that the state had for that period. The state no longer has insurance in that area.
Now, who else was on that plane? Was that the plane that involved Colonel Tom Carroll and Swackhammer? And
through the chair, Senator Taylor, Mr. Swackhammer, and I'm sorry, I don't know his rank at the time, was not on that plane. General Carroll, however, was on that plane. He was the one individual on the plane who was clearly a state employee, and so he was not, his spouse and his estate were not plaintiffs in the lawsuit. They received workers' compensation through the state.
So Colonel Tom Carroll's wife, Bonnie, was barred from being a part of the suit because her exclusive remedy was that of workers' comp?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, I don't know if she had been interested in it. She accepted the state workers' compensation benefits, and that's correct. When you receive workers' compensation, it is your exclusive remedy against your employer.
Okay, and the other people on board the aircraft who recovered $7.5 million, you said total, those were members of the military?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, yes, they were members of the, Major General Himsel was a member of the Indiana National Guard. The pilot was considered a federal employee, and then the co-pilot and the other individuals on the plane, with the exception of General Carroll, were members of the Alaska National Guard. However, they were status that would make them have federal benefits, which they did receive. And because their federal benefits certainly barred them from pursuing remedies against the United States, they did not bar them from pursuing remedies against the state of Alaska. Those claims would be barred under the Ferris Doctrine, but with the change in the law from the Alaska Supreme Court, a different test was substituted.
Okay, so they recovered against the state of Alaska. How? You just told us that it was a federal airplane being piloted by a federal pilot, didn't you?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that is correct. With the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that there was an issue about whether this was a state or a federal mission and whether or not the pilot was a borrowed servant from the federal government such that the state then would be liable for the pilot's actions through the borrowed servant doctrine.
I am a bit confused because I thought that was the same crash involving Swack Swackhammer, but apparently it's a different crash. Somehow our Supreme Court found, contrary to what you've been testifying to, that this was a federal mission. They found it to be a state mission, or there'd have been no liability for the state, would there?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, this went up on a motion for summary judgment. The state filed for summary judgment based upon the Ferris Doctrine. The trial court granted the state's motion for summary judgment. Then it went up on appeal of the state's summary judgment motion. And on appeal, the court held that there was a factual issue whether it was a state or a federal mission, and also an issue whether or not the pilot then was a borrowed servant of the state such that the state would be liable.
Yeah, I understand that. So obviously then it comes back down and it's going to be tried on the issue of whether or not this was a state function as opposed to a federal function. And that's at the point you guys felt so strongly about your case that you settled for $7.5 million, right?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, yes. They're in analyzing the strengths and weaknesses of the case, consulting with the state's excess insurer. The decision was made to settle the case prior to trial.
Okay, so the issue has never been decided by our Supreme Court, has it?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, whether this particular crash was a state or federal mission and whether or not the pilot was a borrowed servant of the state was not decided. However, what was decided is that the Ferris Doctrine does not apply in Alaska, unlike the other states, all but two, and that a new test has been substituted, which is that of whether the injuries arose out of a uniquely military operation rather than the Ferris test of incident to military service. Additionally, the case in footnotes found that the members of the Alaska National Guard were state employees rather than the test that had been applied before, which was you look to who ordered them out. If they were on state orders, they'd be state. If they were on federal orders, federal.
Yeah, I understand the distinction there. Thank you. Could we move on to the next section, which I have as section number 2.
On that point, Senator Olson?
Yeah. Yes, if I could, Senator Taylor. If I could just ask, when the court granted summary judgment in this particular case, it was appealed. Was it appealed on all counts? And did they?
Through the chair, and I'm sorry, I didn't know who asked the question.
This is Senator Olson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Olson. The only motion that was made at the trial court level for summary judgment was to dismiss it based upon the Ferris Doctrine. Determination of the Ferris Doctrine and application would bar the entire claim, so no other issues were briefed at the trial court level, and in fact, there was no record on the other issues, because if the court found, as the trial court did, that the Ferris Doctrine barred the claim.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Go ahead, Senator Taylor.
Yeah, the next section was civil immunity, providing that it's adding a whole new section, apparently. It says a person may not bring a civil action for damages against the state political subdivision, cha-cha-cha, the results of an action or omission in performing or failing to perform activities or duties authorized under a section running from 1860-120 to 1860-175. I just had the book brought to me, but can you summarize for us what 1860 through, I mean, 1860-120 through 175 is?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, yes, those are the sections of the statutes that deal with search and rescue, the titles of the provisions. I'll have in just a moment. AS 1861-20 speaks of search and rescue parties, and then the several sections following that section deals with how things are funded, who may be involved in the search and rescue.
So that then covers all the way down, not only from the troopers who are responsible for dispatch, but all the way down to officers, agents, or employees of the state or a political subdivision of the state. So it would be any of our city, state, or whatever, or borough employees that may be involved in that process are now granted immunity from suit, right?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that's correct. Whoever is participating in the search and rescue activity, including volunteers as agents, are covered under this section.
So there is no qualification on this one. This is just blanket immunity. If it's search and rescue, they're immune. Reckless, gross, intentional, none of that counts, right?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that's correct. There is no exception in Section 2.
And isn't this because we were sued and a judgment rendered against the state when troopers failed to go out and even initiate a rescue or even try to initiate one by dispatching volunteers for an elderly couple and their grandchild?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, we've had a couple of lawsuits out of this area. Currently on appeal to the Supreme Court is the case that did involve the people on the Denali Highway when the highway was closed who went out there. That case did go to trial in Bethel and result in a judgment against the state. In terms of characterizing the facts, what the facts also showed was that the family of these people reported them to be in the Kenai area, and search and rescue activities were initiated in the Kenai area, and it was not until later that they were able to ascertain that despite the reports from the family that they were in the Kenai area, that they may be the people reported on that highway. Also, the weather at the time was 45 below.
No, I understand that you have facts that you lost at trial, apparently. What was the judgment rendered against the state?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, appeal. If all the issues are resolved against the state and in favor of the plaintiff, the total judgment is over $7 million, and that represents the state's share where the jurors allocated fault 51% to the state and 49% to the couple who drove on the closed road.
So they did allocate 49% of the fault to the negligence of the couple that drove down the road. But we've got a $7 million suit. It's pending on appeal before the Supreme Court. And so because of that, we're now going to grant, in this section apparently, blanket total immunity. It doesn't matter if our state employees act negligently, recklessly, grossly, or grossly negligent, or even intentionally, right? I want to just make that real clear.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that's correct. This is, does not provide an exception. It is an immunity that is total. I would also add that it's, subsequent to that case, we had another lawsuit filed that involved decisions about whether to institute a search from one village or from another village and which way to proceed. And so we are now getting these lawsuits, so it's not just the one.
Yeah, so what was the result of that suit? Did you lose that one too?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that case was settled.
Whoa, wait a minute. You settled it? You paid off? You admitted that apparently you had done something wrong and paid money for it?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, as in any civil litigation, there's always a weighing of the possible verdicts that may be rendered in the case, possible damages, and oftentimes decisions are made to settle litigation in order to protect against a larger verdict, such as the $7 million verdict currently up on appeal. In that case, as in all cases, it does not represent an admission of liability, but rather, as in all civil settlements, a weighing of the various factors and strengths of the case.
And what was the amount that you settled for?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, I believe that case settled for approximately $250,000.
Okay, $250,000. And that's why this section's in front of us, isn't it? So that the next two or three losing cases that you've got where we've had some negligent or intentional even or gross conduct on the part of a state employee that damages someone, you won't have to worry about that, will you? That's why this has been brought.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, this bill represents an enunciation of public policy that in order for volunteers and those who are involved in emergency procedures such as search and rescue are able to make the best decisions they can at the time without worrying about civil liability flowing from it, and rather making decisions based upon the safety of the rescuers as well as the people to be rescued.
I understand all that, but I was referring specifically to Section 2, Page 2 of your bill, and for the life of me, I can't find a single word in that paragraph that says anything about volunteers. It talks about public employees who are salaried and paid by the state or a political subdivision. The word volunteer does not appear in that paragraph that you grant total immunity to. So it's a nice emotional argument to make about some poor volunteer might get sued. This doesn't involve volunteers. This is our employees doing negligent acts that cause damage or death to people. Unless you can point out the words, I don't see them.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, volunteers would be covered under the agent's principle.
Under officers, a volunteer becomes an agent of a political subdivision or of this state?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, yes, and for the search and rescue activities, because we do not have enough people to do all the search and rescue activities, the state uses and local communities use a number of volunteers who act as their agents in the search and rescue activities.
Well, I understand that, but you've not cited us to any litigation involving volunteers.
Were volunteers sued in either of the two cases that you're talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, no, the suits were just against the state of Alaska.
That's what I thought. So there weren't any volunteers who were sued. Okay, the next one I had was a concern about, because you do get to volunteers, but that's in Section 7, immunity for government employees and authorized volunteers. And if you could explain that, I would appreciate it, because now we see there is an exception. Now, if it's malicious or reckless indifference to the rights of others or safety of others, then they don't get a blanket on this one. Section 7, page 3.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, is the question why there is an exception in that statute, in that portion of the bill?
Yeah. Why is it there? And in fact, why have you not placed it in the other section so that we don't have somebody who grossly negligent or intentionally even injures or causes an injury to someone in one of these occupations?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that section of the bill, 7, in fact, 7 through 10 that deal with civil defense are amending existing statutes. Under the existing statute for civil defense, there is an exception that carries the exception over, although it also has the clear and convincing standard to it. The reason why exceptions are not included in the other portions of the bill are twofold. First, that immunity is meant to be immunity from suit as well as from liability. The costs of defense alone are quite high. In the Hensel case that we earlier discussed, the cost of defense in that case was $1 million. In the search and rescue case that we discussed, the cost of defense was $250,000. In the firefighting activity, the cost of defense today in the Miller's Reach litigation is $2.5 million. So that when you have exceptions, you create the ability for people to file lawsuits that the state or individual local governments have to defend against, so that even if they are successful in prevailing, a tremendous amount of state resources in terms of cost have to be diverted to the defense of the lawsuits. In order to effectuate the policy behind immunity, that being not distracting people from the jobs they have to do on a daily basis by engaging in litigation as well as the cost. The other portions of the bill do not reflect an exception. The only reason there is an exception in that area is that it carries over from existing statute.
Yeah, I see that, but you've rewritten it so it's even less of an exception than it was before. But I'm fascinated that as we move into the definition of a civil defense worker in 8 and then what civil defense means in 9, it appears to me that you've mirrored federal legislation when it comes to things like homeland security and us worrying about smallpox epidemics, some type of chemical warfare occurring. And so the Congress of the United States, in its great wisdom and compassion, decided that anybody reacting adversely to a vaccination given by one of their people in one of these instances could not sue. And it appears as though we, the state of Alaska, are now adopting a similar policy in section number 9, where if we have a child out there or an adult that we give a vaccination to and they have an adverse reaction and become a quadriplegic for the rest of their life, that's kind of their fault, right?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, it does immunize the activity. However, I would point out that there are existing programs that provide funds for people who suffer adverse vaccinations. And currently, Congress has small recognizes the state and local government and the emergency workers. If someone does suffer an adverse reaction to a vaccination, they would be able to have a remedy through the fund.
I realize some specific funds have been set up for specific types of vaccinations and shots, but that does not include all vaccinations, that which your legislation currently does. It says you have no right to suit based upon an adverse reaction to a vaccination, and we know statistically that in any vaccination program, there is a percentage of people who will have adverse and catastrophic reactions. No way of predicting who they're going to be. I'm incredulous that you're doing each of these things. Tell me about the Miller's Reach fire and how nobody's going to be able to sue us again like the people at Miller's Reach did.
Senator Taylor, hang on one second before we shift to Miller's Reach. Senator Green, question?
On the... Does the fact that it's in this section have anything to do in narrowing the impact of the word vaccination being included in this? Because this is limited to...
This section being, Senator Green, shows where you're at.
It's section 9, and on line 31 on page 4, civil defense means, and then it goes on and is talking about in the context of civil defense. That would not be... I assume, in the context of, and correct me if I'm wrong, all public health vaccinations or services offered by public health. Civil defense is a fairly narrow definition. I don't.
I agree.
I'm just asking the question.
I think, in fact, you're correct, Senator Green. I don't think it includes all public health.
Thank you. I just wanted to be sure.
I agree. I think you're correct that it's specific to vaccination and other actions to protect public health done by
under the auspices of civil defense.
Right, it's quite broad in who all the different people are can do that at the time.
Okay, on to Miller's Reach. Okay, next.
Yes, I just asked her to explain about Miller's Reach and why we've got a Miller's Reach bill here for at least a good section of it, which says if I believe that the system has worked. I believe it worked each time. I believe the system worked when it found that we'd been negligent and we have some judgments pending against us. I believe the system also worked when they went through an extensive trial on Miller's Reach and the plaintiffs were not able to show that there'd been sufficient negligence or inappropriate activities on the part of our state personnel to provide for a judgment against us. I think both of those things show us the system worked. Why are we going to change that now, since it worked?
Senator Taylor, where are you referring to? Section 10?
I'm not sure. She said the last section or two had to do with the fire, and she actually mentioned the Miller's Reach suit. So.
Gail, could you help with that?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, I guess I'm not real clear exactly what the question is. The sections that have to do with firefighting activities are sections 11 and 12 of the bill. In response to the question why this legislation is necessary, again, I would point to several public policy factors. First, the cost of litigation is exceptionally high, both in terms of bringing people off their important jobs in order to have to deal with the civil litigation, and simply the cost to the state itself. As I pointed out earlier, the cost of the state of defending this lawsuit to date is $2.5 million. These sections of the bill also would make Alaska consistent with other Western states and federal case law that holds firefighting as an immune decision. In an emergency situation, they point out that response to the emergency situation involves a great deal of discretion and judgment and best judgment at the time. This bill responds to that case law, primarily in the western states, although it's all over the United States, that they have some form of immunity for firefighting activities. I would point out that Dean Brown, who has been with the Division of Forestry, is on the line as well, and she can speak to the effect that such litigation and lawsuits have on the individual firefighters themselves and the ability of the agency to perform its mission.
You may have misunderstood the question, and I probably poorly phrased it, so I'm sorry for that. I wasn't asking for a sales pitch on why we need to do this, because it might distract some very valuable employee from their duties, or that there would be a high cost to defending actions where we may in fact have been in the wrong and damaged people's property or killed people. What I was asking was, what impact will this legislation have on the ability of the people of the Wasilla area, Big Lake, Miller's Reach, whatever we want to call it, what's going to happen to them the next time we have a fire, and the next time the conduct is worse than it is what was this time around? In other words, what happens when they've actually got a real case where they can really show that people acted, and again, no exceptions are found in this section either, where they acted grossly, where they acted negligently, where they acted recklessly in the manner in which they conducted the suppression of the fire, such that it did damage two people or killed someone? Will those people still be able to sue? And that was my question, really, not the other stuff.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, no, they would not be authorized to file a lawsuit for the firefighting activities under this bill.
And there's no exceptions, again, to this, is there? So gross negligence, reckless disregard of human life, and in fact, even intentional conduct, you can't sue for it, can you?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, not for firefighting activity. I would point out, however, that if an individual's actions rise to the level of violating a federally guaranteed constitutional right, they do have the remedy of filing either in federal or state court under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. This bill does not affect anyone's ability to file such a lawsuit.
1983 is a civil rights suit. I mean, what are the firefighters going to do? Stop the guy from voting? I mean, that's really an incredible response. I'm talking about people who just lost their home, who may have lost a loved one because of the reckless, gross conduct of a state employee in the manner in which they managed this fire suppression. All witnesses agree. The person acted grossly, just unconscionably. There will be no suit allowed, except they might be able to bring a civil rights suit for violation of their civil rights. Is that what this section and the next one are all about? That's a question.
Yep.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, that is correct, that sections 11 and 12 would immunize the state, local government, like local firefighters and volunteers in their firefighting activities. I would point out that under existing Alaska statute, AS 965-070, local firefighters are already immunized under that existing statute.
Yeah. Is there any conditions on those or exceptions on those on local firefighters?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, no. I believe that statute is AS 09.65.070, and there is not an exception.
Ms. Voigtlander, in Section 2 and in Section 11, would you see some need to put in some qualifiers for just the examples that Senator Taylor has brought to you? Gross negligence?
Through the chair, and I'm sorry, I don't know who the question was from.
Go ahead.
The problem with providing exceptions and qualifiers is that you end up having to pay the cost of defense of these lawsuits, even if you are successful. Under Alaska law, in order to have a civil case decided summarily without a trial, there have to be no genuine issues of material fact. The standard for summary judgment is very high in Alaska, and increasingly so, the cases are simply having to go to trial, which means a very high cost to the state and diversion of the state's resources. The case law even provides that even when people agree that there is not a fact issue, but different jurors may have different views as to the inferences to derive from those facts, it has to go to trial.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
For those reasons, there are not exceptions provided.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Let's go to Dean Brown. Dean, your testimony on House Bill 245, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Dean Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Forestry, Department of Natural Resources. And I wanted to address the impact that House Bill 245 will have for forestry and for the state of Alaska on wildland firefighting. As you all know, a major responsibility of the Division of Forestry is wildland firefighting. And we do have increasing wildland-urban interface concerns. As you all know, more and more people are moving into wooded areas, and as a result, we're having increased fires in those areas. Throughout a fire season, we have approximately 86% of our fires are human-caused. During the spring season, virtually 100% of those are human-caused, primarily within the road belt area along the roadmap. Forestry has between 500 and 700 fires per year. Any one or more of those could, in fact, result in litigation, not only against the state, but also against individual firefighters. May 1 is normally the beginning of fire season. This year, we had our first fires on February 4th. We have had to date 157 fires, and fortunately have caught the majority of those on initial attack and kept them below 10 acres. Of particular concern to us is the significant impact that the current litigation has on our firefighters. These are actually seasonal employees who work between 3 to 5 months a year. They are trained to national standards, and many of them become incident commanders, which means they essentially make the major decisions on everything from the very small campfire responses to much larger responses. Their job is fighting fire, and we, for safety reasons as well as success in their job, it's extremely important that their mind be 100% on that job. They do make life and death decisions, and I don't think that's exaggerated. They basically are responsible for the actions of their crews and the public. It's particularly important that they be able to respond directly to those fires and not have to be continually having concerns about what the consequences of those decisions are, because they're well trained, and while we clearly want to make sure they make good decisions, they need to make decisions on the best information they have at the time. For example, during the big windstorm that occurred in the Matsu and Anchorage areas, we had firefighters who in early February were out fighting fires that had occurred because of the windstorm spread across fields into the wildlands. They worked until 5:30 a.m. in the morning and were in court at 8 a.m. And then spent all day in court and were back fighting fires. These types of situations are extremely serious to us in being able to make sure that these people are in a good, safe, and reasonable condition to be fighting fires. But in particular, we currently have a situation where we may well have firefighters on the same fire that include federal and volunteer firefighters, municipal firefighters. And at the current time, the federal firefighters are immune to litigation under emergency situations. And that was recently reaffirmed by the Ninth Circuit Court. As Gail Voigtlander from the Attorney General's office pointed out, this is longstanding precedent and upholding this on the federal level. In addition, the municipal firefighters in Alaska are currently also covered and immune from litigation, both for personal lawsuit as well as municipality. So currently, you have state firefighters and the seasonal employees, which are state firefighters, who are the only ones who are exposed to liability in this situation. This litigation will fill that gap between local and federal firefighters on fires and is extremely important to us as we look at increasing exposure to fires, particularly urban interface, in the state of Alaska. So I would like to thank you for the opportunity to make these comments, and I'm available for questions.
Great. Maybe I could ask a question here, because I guess I don't quite understand what's happening. I'm not an attorney. If I'm a firefighter from Fairbanks and the state has pressed me to service to fight a fire in Fairbanks, and I'm out, I fight it for 24 hours, and I'm really pretty tired, but I decide I'm going to do some speed to keep me going, and I'm under the influence of drugs, and I drive my fire truck down the street, and I run over a kid in the street while I'm fighting the fire because I was high on speed. Am I not then, under this legislation, am I not held accountable for my decision to do drugs on the job?
Through the chair, I need to defer to the Attorney General's office. However, I would like to make the comment that the Division of Forestry, Department of Natural Resources, has a strict policy against alcohol and drug use.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And will be terminated immediately.
Okay, well, that doesn't bring the child back. Is there any other questions for Dean Brown?
Yes.
In regard to forestry? And then my question really was for Ms. Voigtlander, and we'll come back to my question. I'm sorry. Ms. Brown, we have a question from Senator Taylor.
Yeah, there are two sections in the bill, Section 11 and 12, both of which talk about fires authorized to be performed, but they cite to different sections under the statutes. The first, Section 11, cites to 4115.010, And it appears to me 4115.010 is one forest, which I think is a Tanana forest. No, it's just general protected forest lands. And then 4115.17, maybe that's the Tanana. Yeah. Can you explain why we have to have what looks like two identical immunity provisions, and the only difference between them I can find is one is 4115.010, and the other one is 4117.080. Can you explain that?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, again, I'd like to refer to Gail Voigtlander, and there is a good explanation for this. There are two sections within the statute that need to be addressed by this.
Ms. Voigtlander, if you could give us a one-minute question, then we're going to hold the bill and work on the bill. We have other things we need to get to tonight. So go ahead, one minute answer to that, please.
The Section 11 has to do with Title 41, Section 15, which is the forest.
Just hang on 1 second, please. Okay. Okay, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, 4115, which is Section 11, has to do with the forest section of the statute, which provide for firefighting activities. 4117, which is discussed in Section 12, had to do with administration and management. The reason there are these tandem provisions is that under both chapters, forestry is authorized to conduct firefighting activities, and so in order for this legislation to be effective, it had to address both of the chapters.
Just one last one. As I understand general state policy on liability, and correct me if I'm wrong in this,
we make a decision in the legislature, that's discretionary, and they can't sue us for it. When an administrator, say DOT, lays out a highway plan and figures out where they're going to build a new highway, and they design it and they work on that, that's discretionary, and nobody can sue them about that. But when we actually get down to operating the highway, where we're supposed to go out when the highway's dangerous and we're supposed to spread sand on it, and we fail to spread sand on it, then that negligence on the part of the state is actionable, and we, the state, can actually be sued for injuries caused to people traveling on the highways if we've done a negligent job of warning or plowing the snow or whatever. In fact, I think Senator Brad Phillips, who lost his wife in an accident, I think he brought suit against the state for just that very thing. And I think a couple other suits I could cite to you were brought on the same circumstance. So there is a point at which we move past the discretionary decision-making of an administrator who's fighting a fire, and then we get down to the fellow on the ground who's actually carrying out the policy. And is my statement kind of generally appropriate, that where it's a discretionary act or a decisional act, it cannot be sued for, but where it's a ministerial function, plowing the snow or sanding the road, that can be sued for?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, yes, that's the standard description under AS 950-250, the discretionary act being at the policy level kinds of acts, allocation of budget resources and policy matters. However, once that decision is made, then the state can be sued absent any immunity provisions for particular the way in which they conduct an activity.
Thank you very much. You've been very patient, and so has the chairman. I appreciate that. I have many other questions. I could go on for years probably on this stuff. We're not going to. Thank you very much.
Mr. Boltlander, the last thing. Would you reply to my scenario that I gave? Yes, Senator Wilkin.
Yes, Senator Wilkin, and the scenario, I'm sorry, I've lost that question.
I'm a firefighter from Fairbanks that's been pressed into service by the state of Alaska to fight a fire in Fairbanks, and I decide to do drugs, and after I've done the drugs, I run over a kid in my fire truck as I'm fighting the fire. Am I held liable for my decision? Under Section 11?
Already under existing law, under AS 965-070, an action for damages could not be made against an employee or member of a fire department if the claim is for a tort and is based upon the act or omission of the member of the fire department in the execution of a function for which the department is established. So I think in your scenario, Senator Wilkin, the question would be whether the travel and the accident was the execution of a function for which the department is established. If it is, then it would bar the lawsuit under AS 965-070.
Okay, we'll hold this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Senator Olson, we got to get going. Senator Olson.
Just as a matter of public policy, how do we ensure that we have adequate oversight of some body to make sure we have a quality search and rescue operation?
Senator Olson, let's not do that right now. That's okay. A big question with lots of answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's move on to House Bill. Thank you for joining us tonight, Ms. Boltlander and Ms. Brown. House Bill 216. Oh. Robin, would you? Oh. Kennedy, we're back to order, please. Let's see, we have before us House Bill 216. House Bill 216 is a municipal taxation on refined fuel products, sponsored by House Labor and Commerce Committee, chaired by Representative Tom Anderson. House Bill 216 clarifies local municipalities' taxing authority for refined fuels sold both within and outside the local jurisdiction. Prime sponsor, Representative Anderson, if you would, present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to Finance.
Thank you, and if you will notice for the record, because the record won't tell that I have something on. Hi. I learned.
I learned. Motion.
This bill clarifies local taxing authority, Mr. Chairman, as you noted in the title, for refined fuels sold both within and outside of a local jurisdiction. And you being from this area, you'd probably remember when the initiative petition was approved in the Fairbanks North Star Borough to put the question of a 2 cent per gallon transfer tax before the voters. And fortunately, they overwhelmingly defeated that proposed tax in the Fairbanks Borough by a margin of 62% to 38%. But after that, it was recognized by the industry and by business folks that clarification is needed to limit the number of municipalities that can tax the same fuel. In the case of Interior Alaska refiners, fuel is shipped by Alaska Railroad to Anchorage, and it's used in South Central and Southeast markets. But before it reaches Anchorage, it goes through, I count, 8 different governmental taxing entities. So conceivably, those entities could tax, you know, Matsu, Palmer, Wasilla, whatever it goes through, they could tax this fuel. And the exorbitance on the consumer would be probably to the point they wouldn't purchase it. And this type of taxation would result in residents, essentially from other parts of the state, paying local government costs in municipalities they don't reside. And quickly, I would just think of the hypothetical if the Port of Anchorage decided to place a transfer tax on all the freight transiting through the port, the cost of any product shipped through the port would increase, of course, and then residents would be paying for Anchorage, things in Anchorage in the municipality who live outside of that municipality. The bill also clarifies local government's rights to tax any fuel consumed within their government boundaries. Of course, we're not preventing that. But they don't have the right to, or they wouldn't have the ability to tax for value-added products refined and shipped outside. We also have worked with the Municipal League of Alaska and Kevin Ritchie here in Juneau, and he agrees with the current version. I wish he was here. I know Jim Cook is online from Williams. Several small communities currently have transfer taxes, and we certainly we're not affecting current tax statutes or ordinances. One other addition, Carl Morgan, Representative Morgan, added to the bill, I think he was the sponsor, one additional change through the committee process. He raised the loan amount from the bulk fuel revolving loan fund to one borrower in any fiscal year from $200,000 to $300,000. And I think last year he did that up to $200,000. He felt the change was necessary to keep up with the increasing costs associated with construction and replacement of bulk fuel facilities, particularly in rural Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my testimony. If you have really technical questions, I would hope you defer them to Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Questions of the bill's prime sponsor before we go to a teleconference. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know of any local governments that are presently implementing a transfer tax that this would impact?
I'm going to look at my staff. I don't know.
Josh, would you, Josh,
come up and
Josh. Yeah,
Josh actually is being told by one of the facilitators of this bill that there are 3. I don't know the names.
The names are? Facilitator?
So for the record, Coal Bay and 2 other small communities, and we're not affecting those.
Okay, thank you.
And
Senator Hoffman?
And Mr. Chairman, if there are others that you don't know about, they won't be affected as well?
Correct. This puts that grandfather clause in that it is only for future and not non-existing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's how I read it.
Did I see Senator Bundy? Oh, wait. Senator Bundy, then Senator. I'm getting out of sync here.
He answered my question.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, if this is bad policy to have future local governments having a transfer tax, why would we want to allow those that currently have one to continue?
through the chair, my intent, and I said Jim Cook, I meant Jeff Cook, with Williams. I think the intent is, because of this petition in Fairbanks that was in the borough that was denied, I guess the intent was to be proactive, so in the future municipalities could not impose this, but it wasn't to be, I won't say punitive, but I didn't want to tweak other municipalities. Certainly that's an idea, but I, like any sponsor comes to your committee, maybe not in this bill. That's your purview.
Senator Stevens?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, Mr. Anderson, specifically about Section 8.
Section 8, page 3.
Yeah, and I remember this because I was in Labor and Commerce Chairman of this body last year, and we increased that number from 100 to 200, and now within a year we're going to go from 200 to 300. I think you believe in your statement, you said it was for construction, but the bulk fuel revolving loan fund is limited to loans for the purchase of fuel, and further it goes for cities with or communities with populations of less than 2,000 people. I'm just, I have two comments, and maybe we can get an answer. One is how is the integrity of the loan fund when you have the ability to draw on it has increased by almost 300% in a year? And number two is, how many communities less than 2,000 have capacity for tankage of approximately 150,000 gallons or more, which would be what you would have to have in order to buy that? You'd have to actually buy about 180,000 gallons of heating fuel that you'd have to buy in order to reach the maximum of $300,000.
And through the chair, I will be honest, this was added, I can't remember at what committee, at a later committee in the House, and I am not familiar. I'm certainly familiar, but I can't.
It's added in the same committee in the House this year as it was last year. There was a lot of concern and questions in the last year about going from 100 to 200. Now we've gone from 200 to 300. I would just like to have an answer of what the status of that loan fund is. And the last thing we want to do is have a run on the fund.
Josh, can you help us? Are you familiar with Section 8?
Come, you join us. Mr. Chairman, that was
sit down, please.
Representative, my name is Josh Appleby, staff to Representative Anderson. That section was included by Representative Morgan's office because of the rising fuel prices was the main impetus for that section.
Senator Hawkins?
I think there are two other factors. One, that there are upgrades of facilities that are holding more capacities, and I believe that in certain areas, and I have my staff going checking on it, they are looking at trying to put regionalized tanks in so they can buy bulk, larger quantities so that they can purchase them at lower costs. And I have
my staff checking. I don't want to get this drawn off, but I would like to have an answer. I mean, what the size of the fund is, and if we've gone from 100 to 300, and it's a limited pool of capital, I mean, essentially few communities could exhaust the loan capacity in a given year. And I just wonder if it's needed to go to increase that to 300 when essentially you'd shrink your pool of recipients.
What you're wondering, is there money in the bank? Deb, is there a way to look to see what's in the bulk fuel revolving loan fund? Can you see? Let's set aside Section 8. I got that.
Okay.
Let's set aside Section 8 for the moment and talk about Section 1. Let's go to the teleconference. We'll come back to the bulk fuel issue here when we get some more data. We have Jeff Cook online from Williams to testify tonight. Let's ask Jeff, welcome Mr. Cook, if you would, your testimony on House Bill 216.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Cook, and I'm Vice President of External Affairs for Williams Alaska Petroleum. We own the state's largest refinery in Fairbanks, and we refine approximately 70,000 barrels a day of product each day, and about 90% of that, a little over 90%, is shipped by rail to Anchorage and goes through a number of municipalities. In order for our refinery and the other interior refineries to continue our expansion to meet the demands of the entire state, we certainly would not be in a competitive position if we had multiple taxes on fuel. We are doing a value-added process for export. We thought about this legislation last year, but thought it would be disingenuous to pursue legislation before the voters in Fairbanks had their say. We were very pleased with a 62% no vote on the transfer tax. We worked really hard with Representative Anderson and the other people and groups interested in this bill. We have the support of the AML, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and all three refiners in the state, Williams, Petrostar, and Tesoro. And we just feel that this legislation is important to maintain our competitive position and to provide Alaskans with competitively priced fuel. And just I might comment on Section 8 that the reason at one of the hearings they did there was testimony that repayment fund, I don't know what the fund is, but that there was a good history on repayment. They can borrow 90% of the value of fuel, and fuel inflation, and the fact that many of these outlying areas have to purchase only once a year, and it takes them during the year to draw down the cost of that fuel and pay it back was the reason that came in. So that's my testimony. I'd certainly be glad to answer any questions of you or any of the committee members, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of Mr. Cook? Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question for Representative Anderson earlier, I understand the problem of multiple taxation. We have three communities that do have a transfer tax. Is there a possibility that that could create problems, being they're going to be grandfathered in?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, original versions of the bill did include a blanket prohibition, and it became clear that for those entities and municipalities that were levying that tax, that it was going to be a problem. So it was one of the many hard-made compromises that the various parties made to move forward. And we felt that getting a large percentage of what was important in this bill was more important than not getting anything.
Other questions, Mr. Cook? Thank you, Jeff, for joining us tonight. Let's come back to the table. Other questions on the taxation part of this bill? Okay. Let's come back then to the bulk fuel, and we're just trying to get some information. Senator Hoffman, did you get some information?
And Mr. Chairman, okay. Representative Morgan's not in his office, nor is his staff. So I'm. But again, this was not something. If my brother is either way, so I'm not.
Yeah. Why don't Senator Bundy?
I'm just wondering if we heard about Cold Bay, if we have any more information as to what the other two communities were. Cold Bay is obviously.
Mr. Cook, are you still with us?
Going to be in the middle of a transfer.
Yes, sir, I am.
Do you remember the other two communities?
Oh, Senator, I'm sorry, I don't see it. I know Cold Bay, and I can't remember whether Dutch or there was three of them. But
okay.
I apologize. I'm not at a place where I have all my previous files.
Why don't we, let's see, has this, Representative Anderson, this bill had any changes on the Senate side?
No, this bill has not had changes on the Senate side.
So if we get the answers to these questions, we could bring this bill back in the morning? Representative
sure.
Anderson?
Oh, of course, yes.
Is that all right with the committee? Answer your question?
Okay.
We'll get the other two cities. We want to find out who those are, just more curiosity than anything. And we'll get the issue in regard to the bulk fuel.
So rationale and why that was added and what the status is about that in the middle of the
money.
Other two.
What's in the bank account.
Okay.
I want to know what the loan capacity of the fund is.
We'll get a profile of that loan, of that account number. Let's get a profile of what's in it and everything about it. The two cities, what else is in regard to bulk fuel? Okay, let's do that. Let's set the bill aside and come back first thing.
Thanks.
When we schedule, we'll bring it back in the morning.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Taylor, you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, I thought we had testimony on the fuel tax over the other night, where one of the communities, I can't remember if it was on Alaska or where it was.
Just a minute, one conversation at a time. Okay, Senator Kidd?
We had testimony the other night on the fuel tax, that if in fact it was